Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 29th of April. We're going to be talking about swine flu this hour of our program. I know many of you have a lot of questions about this, and we have two guests with us. Joining us for the first part of the program is Pam Bellick. She's a science reporter at the New York Times and has done a question-and-answer piece on the swine flu outbreak in Wednesday's New York Times. And we also, actually, it was in Tuesday, the print section. It's on the web today if you go there to the New York Times, the swine flu outbreak. We'll also be speaking for the entire hour with the associate professor in the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Andrew Pekish will be with us for the entire hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. I'm sure there will be many this hour, and I want to devote as much time to your calls as possible. So I give you the number early on, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Pam, thank you very much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, and also Dr. Pekish, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Pam, do you want to give us a recent update? This story seems to, you know, we're adding to it day by day. What kinds of information do you have this morning that might be new?
Right. Yes, it is definitely an evolving story. I guess the big news is that they have confirmed the first swine flu caused death in the United States was a toddler in Texas whose family had, I guess he was a Mexican toddler, and the family had recently visited Mexico. And I believe the CDC has also confirmed 68 cases of other people in the United States who have been infected. I think public health officials are saying that more deaths are to be expected, and so they are trying to, advise people to be cautious, but at the same time, I think they're trying to put what we know and don't know into perspective and point out that so far most of the cases have been mild and that there are ways to, you know, try to prevent the spread and also to treat it.
Mm-hmm. Is this the kind of story, when you talk about 68 cases, do you imagine by a week from now that will be many, many more? Or is there no way of really knowing how rapidly this is spreading and how many more people will be infected?
I think that there really is no way of knowing, and your other guests can certainly, you know, speak to that from a medical point of view. But the big questions that so far public health officials have not been able to answer has to do with just how widespread the infection rates were in Mexico where this started. And that the answer to that question is very significant to figuring out, what course this might take in the United States. So, for example, in Mexico, I believe they've confirmed 7 deaths, and they have that were confirmed to be caused by swine flu, and they have 150 some odd respiratory-related deaths that are potentially caused by swine flu, but they don't know, or they're certainly not saying, what percentage of people who were infected that represents. And so if it turns out that there were thousands of people who had much more mild infections and, 150 who died, that ends up being a much smaller percentage, which could suggest that as the outbreak takes shape here in the United States, that you may have a relatively small number of serious cases and a much larger number of mild cases.
Dr. Pekish, is that information that people are scurrying to get in Mexico, and does it take a long time to get that information?
There's been the data coming out of Mexico, particularly with this with these two key issues, which is number one, the number of what we would call mild or moderate cases of swine H1N1, and really confirming that some of these respiratory, some of these deaths attributed to respiratory infection really are coming from the from infection with H1N1 swine. Those are the two incredibly important numbers that we need to get in order to put some perspective into how dangerous this outbreak is to humans. You know, the cases outside of Mexico right now really do resemble what we would expect from a strain of flu that is as virulent as our normal seasonal strains. But the numbers that we have outside of Mexico are just not large enough for us to really say that with utmost certainty. The largest population that we have that's been exposed to this virus is in Mexico, and that's what would tell us the most information about how well this virus is spreading from person to person and how virulent or how strong a disease-causing virus it is.
Mm-hmm. You had an interesting front-page story in the Times today about the first person, evidently, who may have had this, and the residents in that local community, La Gloria, saying that the officials were discounting the outbreak at the time, saying to them it was nothing grave. It makes you think, doesn't it? What if people had realized that this was something that we needed to pay attention to and did so right at the get-go, Pam?
Yes, and that could, again, you know, explain a lot about why there ended up, if it turns out that these 150 deaths are attributable to swine flu, it could explain why so many deaths resulted before before officials took action. And again, we really don't know exactly how much they knew, but it's certainly possible, according to public health experts that I've spoken to, that you know that Mexico wasn't as prepared to recognize the signs, and it's also possible that only the most serious cases ended up, you know, seeking treatment, and so there may not have been as many places along the development of the disease for health officials there to have early warning, as is much more common in this country. So that too, how they handled it, what they knew, is an evolving story.
Mm-hmm. And the most cases so far have been in New York. What's the? I'm wondering, are you getting thousands of letters from people worried about this, and you have to go screen to get information to keep people calm?
We are getting a lot of questions. I don't think it's in the thousands yet in the Q&A that I did, but certainly several hundred. You know, I think people are wondering everything from should they be wearing protective masks to what should they be taking special precautions if they're pregnant or if they have asthma. And there are also just a lot of questions about how this differs from regular flu. So I wouldn't say we're getting panic, but I think that people are focusing on this, and they're wondering how it affects them. Also, you know, because there's so much travel back and forth, a lot of people are concerned about what kind of contact they should have with people who have just returned from Mexico. Should they be adjusting their travel plans within the United States? And so we're doing our best to try to provide expert answers to those questions.
Mm-hmm. The president hinted this morning, I'm sure he'll have more to say about this tonight during his press conference, that some schools may need to be closed in parts of the country where there have been cases. What's happening in New York City? Are more schools being closed there, or just the schools that had the students who were infected?
As far as I know, only the schools that have had children infected. I think, you know, other schools are staying on top of it and, you know, trying to, you know, make decisions day by day. I think, you know, Mayor Bloomberg here in New York is trying to also sort of strike a calm but watchful sort of approach, and you know, that seems to be the situation so far here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pam, very much. Pam Bellick, who will continue with her reporting, science reporter for the New York Times, giving us an update of the news today. And she's been getting a lot of questions. She has a Q&A on the swine flu outbreak in the New York Times. If you go online, Q&A, the swine flu outbreak, Pam will give you more information on that particular site. Doctor, I'm wondering how on top of all of this we are in the United States. Do we have the right people in place? Do we have prevention drugs in place in case, we don't know where this is going, but in case it goes to a place where nobody wants it to, are we ready?
And I think that, you know, in contrast to some of the things we said about some of the mixed messages coming out of Mexico, you know, I think that there's a very good awareness of this disease. There's a good distribution of information going on right now from the public health authorities to the media and to the general population. And in terms of preparedness, I mean, there are a lot of hospitals now all across the country that are capable of diagnosing swine influenza. And so in the U.S., I think we're very well prepared and are keeping a very close track on this, on these outbreaks, and are monitoring them very well and very closely.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem here, and tell me if you think this is warranted, there have been huge, it's like these waves of news stories that come, it wasn't last year because we were involved in the election, I think it was 2 years ago, where all of the cable news kept doing these pandemic, we're going to have a pandemic at some point, it's going to kill lots of people on the planet, and I think that you couldn't watch it without becoming somewhat concerned. Now we have something where people say they don't know exactly where it's going. Could this be the next pandemic? Is it like 1918? What's the scope of it, et cetera? And you scare people silly.
And it's an important balance to strike. One certainly wants to have awareness. One certainly wants to have preparedness. But that has to be tempered with really making sure that one's response to the situation is measured and fits the current risk assessment. So, you know, for instance, there's plenty of information out there now from local public health authorities about cases going on in individual cities and individual states. And so it's relatively easy for someone, let's say in Iowa, to be able to keep track of whether or not there are any suspected cases or confirmed cases of swine H1N1 in their area. And the appearance of those suspected cases in their area would really dictate their behavioral changes. So if you're living in New York City right now, your awareness and your precautions that you would be taking would probably be slightly higher than if you were living, for instance, in Iowa, because of the information that's out there. I think that's the important issue to really to bring home to people, is that one just has to realize what the true risk is to you in your local area and take the appropriate measures.
So tell me where this virus first appeared. Was it in an animal?
So we don't have a lot of information on how exactly this virus was derived and how prevalent it was in the animal populations in Mexico and or in other places. Really, the combination of eight genes that this virus has, the first time we've seen this combination is when we started to sequence isolates from patients in California and Texas. So it really is a very unique virus that hasn't been in our databases before. And so there really is no record of this virus circulating extensively. That implies that it was a relatively recently emerged virus. We don't have much information in terms of what happened in Mexico, how broadly it was spreading in animal populations, and there was some speculation, as you mentioned earlier, about where the first cases came from. But again, I don't think there's anything that's clear cut yet that we can make any firm conclusions as to where this virus particularly started and what the farm was that began the outbreak and or those kind of issues.
Do we need to know that answer?
Actually, no. With respect to our public health concerns right now, the most important thing that we need to know is that this virus is spreading from person to person, and as a regular seasonal influenza virus strain does. And any precautions that one person has to take really centers around that central principle, which is if the risk to an individual in the United States comes from coming in contact with a person that's infected, it's not from coming in contact with animals, it's not from coming into contact with pork products, it really is paying attention to where the infected individuals are and making sure that you're taking appropriate precautions with respect to limiting the spread of respiratory viruses.
Mm-hmm. There have been a few articles, and I'm wondering if you would go this direction with this, that looked at the way that animals, particularly pigs, are being grown in Mexico and in other parts of the country. And there have been some questions about animals being in very close contact, not monitoring enough the waste that comes from the animals going into the rivers, et cetera. Does that warrant investigation? Is that part of the problem here, do you think, or not?
We know from over 15 years of research in this area that swine in particular do have a tendency to be able to not only have their own endogenous influenza virus strains, but they have a propensity to be infected with both human influenza virus strains as well as avian influenza virus strains. And that's put forward this hypothesis of swine as a mixing vessel where different influenza viruses that normally circulate in very diverse animal populations can come together, exchange genetic material, and new variants of influenza can then emerge. So certainly it's very clear that pigs can be infected with a number of different animal strains and animal strains of influenza. And any kind of housing or animal farming practices that bring together multiple animal species into a very close confinement will certainly make that kind of a transfer from species to species of viruses much more likely.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that farming practices do play into this. In particular, when we look at small farmers who have very limited space to hoard their animals and oftentimes do house all of their animals together, it's those types of environment that do pose a much greater risk for species jumping and genetic exchange between influenza viruses from different species.
Mm. I read yesterday that Egypt killed all the pigs in the country.
Yeah, and it's an interesting example of where understanding what the threat really does represent to you is critically important for an appropriate response. So, you know, there's no data whatsoever that this virus is present in Egypt and that there's any significant transmission of this virus from pigs to humans. So while that's an effort that's made to stem the epidemic, and it's probably made in good faith, it really has very little practical consequence for limiting the spread of swine H1N1 in Egypt.
Right. Before we go to phone calls, and I'm sure we'll have many, the other thing that we hear is that this might peter out, but it could be going underground, and watch out for this flu coming back with full force and then some in the fall.
And there is some precedent with influenza virus strains. Usually, come end of April, beginning of May, influenza activity really does drop to a very, very low level. That's probably due to seasonal factors as well as environmental factors that really limit the ability of the virus to spread from person to person. So this virus emerged very late in the season. It will probably be contained by these natural methods in a short period of time. What we won't know is whether or not it will be returning in the fall, and that has incredibly important implications for vaccines and vaccine choices, which hopefully we can discuss later.
Yes, let's see. All right, yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that in just a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is Dr. Andrew Pekish, Associate Professor, Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Health. We are talking about the swine flu this hour of the program. And he can answer the questions that you have. We have a few lines open right now. talk@wpr.org is our email address. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and let's start with Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Everybody that I know has been getting a flu shot every fall, including last fall, because we've been told that the flu season is when everybody is inside. How is the, what's the big concern? Because everybody's gotten their flu shot.
There really is, the influenza vaccine that one gets every year is a relatively good vaccine. It's fairly effective. There are two drawbacks to that vaccine. One is that the amount that the protection induced by the flu vaccine only lasts for anywhere from 6 to 9 months in total. So it really doesn't carry over extensively into the next flu season, which is why you always have to get a seasonal influenza virus shot every year, even if you had one the previous year. The other thing about the seasonal flu vaccine is that it consists of three strains of influenza virus, only one of which is an H1N1, which is distantly related to the swine influenza. But the immune response generated to the vaccine is fairly specific to the strain that's included in the vaccine, and it wanes very quickly as you get to strains that are unrelated to the vaccine strain. So it turns out that the H1N1 that's present in this year's seasonal influenza vaccine generates an immune response that is very poorly reactive with the swine H1N1. And so while the seasonal flu vaccine is an excellent match for seasonal influenza virus strains circulating, the immunity induced by that vaccine doesn't go far enough over to cover the swine H1N1.
So can we be hopeful that we will have that vaccine by next fall?
So I think that there's a lot of cause for optimism. We have the virus isolated. CDC says that it's relatively straightforward to grow this virus. And in fact, CDC has already said that they've started the process of generating what they call seed stocks of the vaccine. So what CDC does is they identify the strains that we want to make vaccines for. They generate virus stocks of that particular vaccine, and then they distribute that to the vaccine manufacturers who take over in terms of the large-scale manufacturing of the vaccine. So CDC has already started this process, and it certainly doesn't seem from from this early time that there are any major stumbling blocks in terms of generating a vaccine.
So, I'm sorry.
The biggest issue is really time.
Right.
It takes about 4 to 6 months from the decision to which strain is going to be in the vaccine to having enough of that vaccine to begin immunization studies, to begin immunization of the population. The choice of next year's seasonal flu vaccine took place about 5 weeks ago, and in fact, many of the vaccine manufacturers are already busy making next year's seasonal flu vaccine. So if we want to devote resources to make a swine H1N1 vaccine, we have to, number one, take some resources away from the seasonal influenza vaccine because there's not a lot of surge capacity to make more of a different kind of influenza vaccine. And two, we have to make this decision relatively soon. Otherwise, we won't have the vaccine available in time to efficiently immunize the population before the next flu season.
Oh, that's interesting. So who's making that decision?
So that decision is usually made by the World Health Organization and in combination with public health agents from most of the major governments around the world. And I believe today the WHO is having one of their emergency meetings to go over the progress in terms of swine H1N1 and to discuss capabilities of vaccine manufacturers to switch over to generating a swine H1N1 vaccine.
I would imagine they would go ahead and do that. Can you think of any reason they wouldn't?
Because this is so early in the epidemic, we really don't know if this will be the virus that's going to emerge in the next flu season. So that's, I think, one reason to be calm. Getting back to the example you mentioned earlier in the show in terms of the 1976 swine outbreak, there was a case where we had about 200 cases of an H1N1 infection towards the late spring. There was an assumption that was the virus strain that was going to emerge in the fall. We had a mass vaccination campaign, and that virus never emerged in the fall. So we ended up vaccinating a lot of people against a virus which never emerged. And that is certainly something, as a public health agency, we don't want to do. The implication of that as well, though, is because our capacity to make influenza vaccines is limited. If we decide to make a swine H1N1 vaccine, we will most likely not make an H1N1 vaccine that recognizes the strains of influenza that are currently circulating in the human population. And so we leave ourselves vulnerable because we're not immunizing people with the H1N1 that's currently in the human population, but we are immunizing against something that we predict will be in the human population. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's such a very difficult decision to make, particularly given the timeline that we're on in terms of when the decision has to be made.
Right. So wouldn't it be, what about just going the direction of having massive quantities of Tamiflu and what's the other one that seemed to take care of this?
And again, if we're going to look at positives about this outbreak, one of the positives is that the swine H1N1 appears to be very sensitive to the Tamiflu and Relenza anti-influenza virus drugs. And those drugs have been shown to be very effective in terms of limiting disease caused by influenza as long as that's as long as they're taken within 48 hours of the onset of symptoms. So we certainly have antiviral drugs which will work against the swine H1N1s that will, I'm sure, be very important in terms of limiting the disease caused by this virus.
Right. Let's go to Jeff from Amory. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I just have a comment. It's actually kind of a question. First of all, he mentioned earlier in his opening remarks that the small agricultural enterprises will be more susceptible to the creation of these viruses. But I think we should really look at our food supply in general because this particular virus, from what I've heard and listened to and reports, came from a factory farm. Actually, it's an American-owned corporation farm that does the raising and slaughtering, where they have pigs in confinement, and they're filthy. If you've ever been in a confinement operation, a modern one, and they have to treat these animals with drugs on a regular basis, not only to keep them healthy, but also to improve their growth rate. And I think it's an injustice to imply that small agriculture is more susceptible or more, how should we put it, more probable cause of this type of thing, when our large agricultural operations are going to cause us more problems down the road. And I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I'll get off the line and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
So I certainly did not mean to imply that we in any way knew the source of this H1N1 swine influenza virus. Right now, it really is a big question mark in terms of where it was, where it first emerged, and how it entered the human population. Certainly, there are some reports from news agencies and on the Internet suggesting that there are large swine manufacturing companies there where this may have emerged from. I think it's too early for us to really speculate on that. So my point was not necessarily to point a finger at small farmers as the probable cause of this outbreak, but simply to mention the fact that it's the kinds of farming practices that bring multiple animals together in the same area that can perpetuate these types of emergence of new influenza virus strains.
Betty is next from Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. What an interesting subject. My question is, or my comment, so many of our food products are coming from Mexico, like our grapes and our produce, especially, and also manufactured goods are coming from Mexico. Now, could that virus be transported from these products, from handling these products into the United States?
There certainly could be a risk associated with that. But with respect to the cases of H1N1, swine H1N1 that we're seeing in humans, virtually everything that all the cases that we've identified so far can be traced back to individuals who have traveled to Mexico and who are now being exposed to people who were infected with the virus. So there are certainly other pathogens that are present on food items that are certainly, you know, a risk to the human population. But when it comes to the swine H1N1, the real risk right now is coming from humans that are infected and spreading that virus to other humans.
Thank you, Betty, for the call. Here's an email. First question's already been answered from Muriel. I recently read a story about how the number of migrating birds has drastically decreased. Can there be any connection between this and swine flu? And the other question is, I leave tomorrow for Dallas, and I'm wondering if I need to take any special precautions, such as a mask, while on the plane or in the Dallas airport.
So with respect to the first part of the question, this virus that's emerging, this swine H1N1, really is a swine influenza virus. It has some genes from an avian influenza virus, but those were picked up several years ago by swine influenza virus during one of those reassortment events that I referred to earlier. So there's probably not a direct connection between migratory birds and the emergence of this strain of swine influenza virus in the human population. When it comes to travel, again, I would emphasize that if one has to travel, one should pay attention to where one is traveling and get a sense of whether or not there are any cases of swine H1N1 diagnosed in those areas. If one was traveling to New York City, for instance, then certainly one might take some precautions when one gets there in terms of, again, these things like washing one's hands, maintaining a distance from people, because that would be an environment where there certainly are diagnosed cases. And so I think measured response is the important thing. See where you're going, and if there are no cases of swine influenza there, then one should not alter your plans in any way. If there are cases of swine influenza there, then it really depends on how extensive the outbreak will be. If it's only a few cases, one can certainly travel there and with taking minimum precautions, feel relatively safe.
Thank you, Betty, very much for the call. Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I guess I was looking for a practical assessment of this.
I can't hear you very well, Scott.
I'm sorry. I said I was looking for a practical assessment of this because a couple of years ago, we were all going to die from avian bird flu. I mean, it just was all over the press that this is the great new pandemic that's going to sweep down and kill us all. And I was watching one of the national news last night, I mean, at 5:30, and the headline was that it was rapidly across the nation. You know, and it seems to me we get, and I want to take it seriously, obviously, but it seems to me the coverage that it gets and the hysteria that's caused, purpose, I guess. And I'm just wondering, I mean, how truly serious is this when in the past we've experienced things like this, like the avian bird flu is the exact same thing. I mean, it was just pandemonium.
Okay.
Crazy.
Dr. Pakish?
You know, it's an excellent question. If I can compare the H5N1 outbreaks that we've been dealing with since 2002 to the H1N1 outbreaks that we're dealing with right now, when H5N1 human cases first emerged, what was most surprising about those was the fact that infection was associated with an incredibly high mortality rate. And even today, the mortality rate from H5N1 infection in humans is in the range of 40 to 50%. In other words, half the people who get infected with H5N1 end up dying. And that was what was really a sobering point for us when we were seeing the H5N1 infections. The H5N1 virus was never able to spread efficiently from person to person. And so we kept waiting for that part of the virus genome to mutate and for it to acquire that aspect. The swine H1N1 has done the opposite. It seems to have been able to acquire the ability to infect humans and spread from person to person relatively efficiently. Yet it doesn't seem to be carrying with it the highly virulent or deadly nature that the H5N1 virus is associated with. So we have the same two worries that we have with a pandemic. One is how virulent or how well can this virus cause disease, and two is how easily can it spread in the human population. The H5N1 was very deadly but can't spread in the human population right now, whereas the swine virus can spread fairly easily in the human population, but it's not as deadly as the H5N1 is. So the same basic principles are at work here. It's just that the two viruses have acquired different properties and therefore represent a slightly different risk to us.
Thanks very much for the call, Scott. Let's go to Steve from Onalaska. Hi, Steve.
Hello. First off, I think your program is hitting the right stride. It's answering questions without pushing the panic button. Somebody called in and said about how this was off a large American-owned pig farm. And CNN has online has a story right now that says that 5-year-old Edgar Hernandez was the earliest known case of swine flu. And he lives in a 3,000 population village of La Gloria in Veracruz. And that he got it April 2nd, and that he is fully recovered. And this is an area, basically, the article goes on to say, is of small pig farms, which are, in essence, up a dead-end gravel road. So I doubt very seriously if this was anything more than what they said it was, which is, you know, an area of small pig farms. But I would also like to say that, you know, your chances of getting this flu right now are about as, you know, you probably have a better chance getting sunstroke in Antarctica. It's just, you know, we're talking 68 cases out of 300 million. It was reported this morning that the small girl that passed away in Texas was a Mexican national who was sent to Houston as a for treatment, and that she was sick when she came there. And, you know, she's not a Texas resident. She's not even an American resident. She was sent up here for treatment. And, you know, too bad that it didn't work. But I think we just all need to keep this in perspective. You know, I have a trip still planned in June to go to Mexico, and I haven't changed my plans. And at this time, I'm not planning on it. I just think that, you know, people need to realize that this, you know, with the normal precautions of taking care of flu viruses, that you can travel fairly well.
What do you think? Should he go to Mexico, Dr. Packish?
So much can change between now and June that, you know, you probably shouldn't make a decision right now about that. Hmm. But, you know, I think, you know, there's one point that does resonate here, and that's we have to differentiate the effort that's being put into monitoring this outbreak from the public health perspective versus the response from the general population. So there's a lot of signals here that tell us in the public health community that this is something that we really should be monitoring very, very carefully and very, very closely. And so the response from the public health organizations have been very sound, very robust, and very, very appropriate. And when it comes to the general population, again, one has to keep track of their environment and understand the risk to each individual person based on where they live and where they plan on traveling. We have a small number of cases right now in very well-defined geographic areas. It's a concern for us in terms of monitoring and keeping track of this and making sure that we're following the virus's spread as quickly as possible. But there certainly isn't a need for, there certainly isn't a need for people to overreact across the country.
Thank you, Steve, very much for your call. We have a couple lines open. If you've been trying to get through, our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Andrew Packish is our guest as we talk about swine flu this hour. He's associate professor, Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Packish, let's go to another email, two-part question here, maybe one. I understand that this epidemic may possibly go in waves, as the 1918 epidemic did. We talked about that, mild and then a more deadly wave in the fall. If you catch the flu in the mild wave and recover, are you better protected from the more virulent form that hypothetically strikes months later? Or could the virus have changed so much by then that your earlier infection may give you no extra immunity to the later one?
So usually the immunity that's generated from a virus infection is much, much stronger than the immunity generated from the vaccine. And that immunity has been shown with influenza to provide protection for at least 3 to 5 years after an infection, and in many cases, much longer than that. Now, the caveat to this is that there's always a chance that the virus can mutate and change its surface coats to make it less resistant to the immune response that was generated in the previous year. So that's the variable that we can't quantify, because that is an event that occurs randomly. So certainly any infection with a swine H1N1 should provide a very long-lasting immunity from infection. Now, whether or not this virus is going to come back again in a second wave first, which is the first part of the question, and two, whether that second wave is going to be a more virulent virus, again, these are just questions that we don't have answers to. There are several examples. The 1918 epidemic certainly worked in that way. The pandemics that occurred in 1957 and in 1968 also seemed to have two waves, and there was not huge differences in virulence between the two waves of those viruses. So it's speculation right now to assume that there will be a second wave, and that second wave will be of higher virulence. But it's something that we certainly have to keep track of.
Mm-hmm. You just have to live, everybody does, with some measure of uncertainty about all of this.
And unfortunately, we've put on top of this these timeline constraints that I talked about, in terms of the fact that some of these decisions are going to have to be made before we have all of the information which we would feel comfortable with having. And, you know, obviously that's going to bring in a lot of second guessing.
Right.
To the whole process. But unfortunately, that's the situation that we were put into with the emergence of this virus strain so late in the flu season.
Thank you so much. Oh no, for your email. Let's go to John for a call now from Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi. My question is, based on the fact that you're dealing with a virus here, are there any advantages to using an antibacterial soap?
Well, washing your hands with any kind of soap is an excellent means of limiting the spread of respiratory viruses, because it eliminates the viruses and the other bacterial pathogens that can get on your hands from either you yourself sneezing, therefore spreading the virus to other surfaces, or picking up the virus from surfaces such as, for instance, doorknobs, where multiple people are using the same piece of equipment, and therefore there's a chance of a lot of contamination there. So a good hand washing with any kind of soap will get rid of a large number of viruses and other bacteria that are on your skin. Many of the sanitizers, especially the alcohol-based sanitizers, also work very well in terms of inactivating viruses. And so both of those things are key components of a good hygiene process that will limit the spread of respiratory viruses.
And one other question while I got you in the line. A virus isn't really considered a living thing, right? It needs a host to replicate in. And how do you kill something that's not actually alive?
So, yes, we use the term kill against the virus, but I guess perhaps a better term would be destroy. The virus in and of itself is an entity. It's, let's say, for instance, it's like a tissue box. It has a certain shape. It has a certain content. You can take that tissue box and crush it and make it basically unuseful. And so that's basically what we do when we talk about disinfectants and those kind of things. We take the physical particle and we disrupt it so that it can no longer attach to cells and initiate an infection cycle.
So the alcohol is good at destroying the tissue box or destroying the virus, but the antibacterial per se doesn't do anything to it.
Right. And, of course, the physical act of washing your hands and just simply removing these virus particles from your hands is another benefit.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call. We were talking in the car, my son and I, on the way to school today, about people in your profession actually listening to a report on this, wondering if you become hyper-cautious because you're dealing with this every single day. I mean, do you, doctor, wash your hands more often, or do you worry more about this than all of us, or are you more calm about it? Or I just wonder how you take it in.
Well, you know, we work with influenza virus strains on a daily basis here in the laboratory, and when we work with viruses, we certainly have levels of precautions that we have to take, because, again, many of the viruses that we work with are human viruses, and there always is a chance of us acquiring an infection through
through accidental means. So we certainly not only emphasize these kind of things that we're talking about here, but we practice them on a day-in, day-out basis because that's what we as investigators have to do if we're working with the virus.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I almost hate to ask the question, but I guess somebody has to. It seems to me here, Doctor, we're dealing with something that is kind of a known entity in the sense that we've had, you know, previous experience with situations like this. And we're dealing with something that, you know, we don't know how bad it's going to be, but apparently it's not too bad right now, looking percentage-wise, population and number of infected people. My question is, let's suppose that this was something that was targeted. Let's talk about bioterrorism, in which, you know, we're dealing with something that's particularly nasty. It seems that there's a long time between the time it's detected and that we can come up with some kind of a solution and then get it out to the population. Boy, that's a real scary scenario. Are we prepared for something like that?
So let's start by just, I want to be very clear that there certainly is no evidence that this particular H1N1 swine influenza virus is in any way any kind of a bioterrorist agent or any kind of signature of being generated in a laboratory or anything like that. We now have plenty of sequencing data that was just uploaded from the CDC yesterday to public access sites. And all of that information suggests that this is a unique combination of some swine influenza viruses that has somehow acquired a new property and is now circulating in the human population. Now, there is a good point about how this type of an outbreak really tells us something about how prepared we are for a bioterrorism outbreak. And again, I would argue that the response that you've seen in the United States has actually been a relatively good response with respect to the public health agencies being able to identify cases, diagnose those cases, and then communicate that information to the central location like CDC as well as to the other public health organizations and the general public. It is probably breaking down in certain areas, such as Mexico, because we certainly aren't getting anywhere near as much information from Mexico as we are getting from the United States, from the European community right now, from Israel, from New Zealand, the other places where we've had cases of swine H1N1 emerge. So I think when it comes to the U.S. public health system and its ability to respond to a bioterrorism attack, this is a good example that says that we are fairly well prepared for that, and we have the infrastructure in place that can help us respond to that.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello.
Hi.
Kudos to you and your guests. This is a very good program. Several of the callers have raised something like the same issue. So, briefly, this is the same type of virus as that was associated with Spanish flu in 1918. And there's a chance that it may simply be extinguished over the summer or that it could reemerge this fall in a more virulent form. So could I ask the question to what degree the guest thinks that the circumstances for a reemergence would be anywhere comparable with 1918? And thank you very much.
Thank you, Frank.
So I think that the comparison to 1918 really works on one level, and that is that the 1918 virus was an H1N1 virus, which is the same designation as this swine H1N1. This virus really doesn't have any other biological properties that we know are associated with 1918. For instance, one of the primary properties was the fact that the 1918 influenza virus strain appears to be primarily, if not completely, comprised of genes from avian influenza virus strains, whereas this swine influenza virus has genes that have been present in the swine population for at least 5 to 10 years, if not longer. So in terms of biological properties that we know of so far, this virus does not really resemble 1918. It more resembles the H1N1 human influenza viruses that are currently circulating.
Hmm. Where do you recommend we go for information about all of this?
I think that there are really two very good sources. One is the CDC which has a site completely dedicated to swine influenza virus.
Okay.
And then the WHO also has, the World Health Organization also has a site dedicated to swine influenza virus. The WHO site focuses mostly on cases outside of the U.S. and Mexico. The CDC website focuses on the cases that are present within the United States and Mexico.
Okay. Well, you've been
and I'm happy to pass on those web links to you so you can post them on your website.
Oh, wonderful. All right, we'll do that. Thank you so much. What a wealth of information you've been.
Well, appreciate thank you very much.
Thank you. Our guest, Dr. Andrew Pekish, Associate Professor in the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology, Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health. And if you go to our website, he will pass along those links. So it's WPR.org. Go to the little area that says, what's our show called? Conversation with Kathleen Dunn, I guess. How darn original. In there, you'll get some more information about where to get more information that's up to date and that's thorough and non-sensational. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder on air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Just a reminder, President Barack Obama's 100 days in office press conference, where I'm sure he'll be dealing with this issue we just discussed, is tonight at 7 o'clock. We will be carrying this. NPR will have a feed for us. So listen, it starts at 7 right here. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.